This is a podcast about Jeopardy!
Hello and welcome to Potent Potables, your weekly Jeopardy! Podcast where two former competitors bring you recaps and analysis of the week's Jeopardy! Episodes, a deep dive into a topic inspired by one of those episodes, and a quiz. I'm Emily.
And I'm Kyle. And this is the week of April 22nd, 2024. That's weird to me that we're already almost through April. I don't know, I just had a moment of good Lord. Didn't it just become 2024?
I accidentally wrote April something 2014 the other day, so.
You'll catch up.
I will, eventually, or not.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've got some Jeopardy to talk about. It's almost weird to be back in the normal swing of Jeopardy episodes, but yeah. We'll get there after we check in with each other. Emily, how's it going?
It's going all right. My quirky puppy is adorable as usual, and my golden doodle is a great big dog sister, and I have started doing functional fitness circuit training again, which is the workout thing that was working for me before COVID. The place I used to go closed, but a new one opened, so I'm going there. I don't know, like, the Jeopardy stuff, people may have discerned that I am kind of a competitive person who likes a certain degree of intensity. And so, like, I'll go hang out at some school event, and the other moms will be like, what do you do for exercise? Oh, I like to go to the Pilates studio. Oh, I like to go to the bar class. It's so serene. It's like exercising in a spa. And I'm like, I want my exercise to feel like I might have to fight a bear. So that's what I'm getting from this. It's good. That was so far so good. I'm very sore, but feeling very accomplished. How about you?
I'm good. Things are going fine. Yeah, my wife and I are going to be running the Boulder Boulder, which is a 10K on Memorial Day. It's one of the biggest 10Ks in the country. Whoa. And we have done it. We've done it the last few years. I ran it in the last decade. I ran it in like 2010, 11, and 12, and 13. Oh yeah, I ran it 2013. That was like the week I got married. Yeah. So it's really fun as far as runs go. Like, the atmosphere is really great. There are, you know, 50 to 60,000 people running it. Mm-hmm. And all of Boulder kind of shuts down to enjoy it. People who live along the route, you're just running through neighborhood for a lot of it. And people just like put out stuff in their yard. There's a belly dancing troupe that will belly dance. There are a bunch of bands. One house has homemade mead that they give out to you as you're running.
That's
by.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. The problem is it's a 10K, and that's longer than I want to run. So we have started training for it. And I wouldn't say that it's like fighting a bear. It's more like fighting gravity for longer than I want to.
Yeah.
But it's okay. We're going to do it. We're going to make it.
The time that running worked best for me was when there was an app that had like connected to my GPS on my phone, and it had audio, and it was like a narrative where you were trying to escape zombies. And it could tell how fast you were going. It's like the zombies are gaining on you. Like ominous music.
That's really funny.
Yeah. It was called Zombies Run. I don't know if it still exists. But yeah, no, I think my commitment to like workouts where I can imagine that I'm in an action movie has been a thread throughout.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds motivational. I certainly would, I think, be a little bit more into it if I was like, oh, I might die if I don't stop running.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's how we're doing. So yeah, I guess the weather has gotten warmer. And so we are like, time to take care of physical fitness.
Hibernation is over.
Yeah. Bummer. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we have Jeopardy episodes starting with Monday, April 22nd. And the contestants, Ellie Trickett, a blog and podcast editor from Danbury, Connecticut. Nam Nguyen, a playwright from Mississauga, Ontario, Canada. And Marco Sarek, a math professor from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, whose two-day cash winnings total $26,600. Jeopardy round categories are Take Me to the Bridge, Booked in Books, Last Name's the Same, an Emmy-winning role, also a basketball term, and The Sunday Scaries.
Uh-huh.
Which I guess I understand the term Sunday Scaries, but I always In our house, we call them the Sunday mopes, because it wasn't so much like anxiety or like nerves. It was more just like, man, I don't want Monday. I want it to be the weekend still.
Mm-hmm. I cannot identify with the Sunday scaries. Well,
your Sundays are a little bit different than most people's Sundays.
Yes, indeed.
Although I will say now, I don't get the Sunday scaries anymore. My job is far less stressful.
Yeah.
And to a degree, Mondays mean like, the kids go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to return
don't go to school.
My yeah, I don't. I get to go and like reassert my routine. So that's nice.
Yeah.
The $400 level, though, feels awfully targeted. Mr. and Mrs. Jones are nervous about the haggling coming up on Monday, but look forward to getting a new SUV, a Sorento, from this company. Marco got that. That's Kia. Now, I know that we know that at least one of the writers listens to our podcast, but how did you know that we have a Sorento?
Oh, you
do? How did you know that? That is creepy.
Yeah.
Although we didn't have to haggle for it because we went to CarMax where they don't haggle, which was fine. I actually enjoy haggling for things that are meant to be haggled.
Mm-hmm.
My wife hates it, and she hates being around me when I do it because I take the attitude that a salesperson is not a person when they are trying to sell me something.
That's a take.
I am not a person to them. I am a pot of gold that they are attempting to take as much out of as possible.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And my job is to not give them as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not about them being a person. I don't get personal and be like, you're a asshole. You know, like,
right.
I don't like attack them or anything, but I don't have to care about being nice or about being particularly honest in any way. Mm-hmm. And really, it's a game.
Okay.
It's a game. And I approach it as such.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But my wife cares about people in a way that I don't, which is why she's a better person than I am. And so she does not care for that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm all for caring about people, and I am not especially good at haggling. But I think a lot of car sales tactics are predicated on taking advantage of people's instincts to be polite, nice, and honest.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, yeah, you're probably wise to handle it like a game.
I think I am, too.
Yeah.
That has resulted in the times that I have done it, getting pretty good deals on things.
Nice.
Yeah. Anyway, other things. The $800 level of last name's the same, of an accused axe murderer and her distant cousin who invented a process for condensing milk. Mark also got that. That's Borden. I never looked it up, but I had always been curious. You know, like Borden's condensed milk.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe not even curious. I just, when I hear the name Borden, I think, Lizzie Borden. Whether it's related to that or not. And apparently they are related.
Huh.
Hmm.
Huh. Yeah.
Yes.
Huh.
Which just confirms to me that my assumption that all last names are related to each other if they are the same.
Mm-hmm.
It just confirms that.
Yeah.
It must be true.
Must be true. Daily Double number one is in Take Me to the Bridge at the $600 level, pick number 7. Marco finds it. He's at 3,600, with Nam and Ellie tied at 600. He makes it a true Daily Double, and he gets the clue. The world's longest rotating metal bridge, El Fardon, spans the western shipping lane of this Egyptian waterway, dating to 1869. And he gets that correct. It's the Suez Canal. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Marco's at 12,800. Great score. Nam is at 5,200. Ellie's at negative 400. And the Double Jeopardy categories are Secrets of the Octopus, Historical Figures, Zimbabwe, Libraries, and the Roll Almost Goes To, and Six Syllable Words.
I just realized why I dislike that category name, and the Roll Almost Goes To. It's because we're so used to hearing and before the last category title.
Oh, yeah.
Not only like, you know, in a podcast, but like through 4 decades of Jeopardy, that's how it's always presented.
Yeah.
And that is, ooh, it throws me off. But speaking of that category, can you imagine, although actually I don't know if we've really talked about, if you're a Lord of the Rings fan, but the $1,600 level. After a phone call with Peter Jackson, Russell Crowe turned down this role and a ton of money that went to Viggo Mortensen. Can you imagine if Russell Crowe was Aragorn?
Absolutely not.
It just
absolutely not.
No, I mean, no. You know, like Viggo Mortensen was, you know, I realize like in retrospect, I had no reason to think this before, but like he is Aragorn, right? Like he was so good in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Russell Crowe would, I don't know,
ruin it.
Yeah.
Respectfully.
It just wouldn't be Aragorn. Like Russell Crowe would make a much better like Boromir, you know? Like, okay, not to say that okay. Sean Bean was not a good Boromir.
I just don't want
Boromir.
Russell Crowe to touch any movie that I like. Like, he could be the sure, gladiator that's... guy, and that's it.
Sure, that's fair, and that's fine. I'm just, you know, I'm just thinking back 20 years
yeah.
to the production of these films. Like, but yeah, no, I think his whole deal would just not work, which maybe he agreed with, and maybe that's why he turned it down, or mm-hmm. you know, whatever. So.
Yeah. We had a little bit of a guessing strategy error in that category also. The 20th pick, the $2,000 level, Akira Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress helped inspire Star Wars, and the role of Obi-Wan was reportedly offered to this star. There was a picture. Nobody tried that. That is Toshiro Mifune, who I am not familiar with. And then 8 clues later, the $400 level, if not for his Magnum PI contract, Tom Selleck, not Harrison Ford, might have played this iconic character. And Nam tried, who's Han Solo? We should know at this point, there's probably not 2 Star Wars facts in the category.
Probably not. Yeah.
So Marco got the rebound with Indiana Jones.
I mean, either way.
Again, absolutely not. If it was Han Solo
or Indiana Jones. Yeah, like Tom Selleck. I don't know. Maybe it's because Magnum PI is just so like ingrained in my mind as who Tom Selleck is that it's like, yeah, absolutely not. It couldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
Harrison Ford has to be Indiana Jones. And maybe he'd have done a great job, but I just don't. It just wouldn't work.
Yeah. Octopuses, octopodes, are so cool and so terrifying.
They are.
They're like and scary smart.
They are, and in fact, so much so that my wife has insisted that when we go and eat sushi, I no longer get octopus, because she's like, they're sentient. You can't do that anymore. And I was okay.
The correct plural of octopus is octopodes or octopodes or something that's like P-O-D-E-S.
Now, when you say correct, who decided that it's correct?
I don't know. Like, I think it's from the Greek, Latin, I don't know. Anyway, it's one of those weird, like, classical suffixes that...
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, but here, dictionary.com says octopi is acceptable.
Yeah, that's... I always thought it was. And I, honestly, I remember learning somewhere that octopuses is also acceptable, like, for English speakers, right? Like, the English plural of it would be octopuses.
Yeah.
And, like, the Latin plural would be octopi. So, like, both are acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what I remember being told. Anyway, the $800 of libraries reminded me of my own a Jeopardy episode. The clue is this city's public library on Boylston Street has murals that John Singer Sargent spent decades on. Oh, you got it. That's Boston. I'm going to be going to Boston next week, so maybe I'll check it out. And also, John Singer Sargent was a correct response that I could not remember in one of my episodes.
Oh, no.
But it's okay.
Yeah. Things turned out okay for you in the end.
Yeah, I don't regret things. No regrets. All right, Daily Double number 2 is in historical figures at the $1,200 level. Pick number 3 is pretty early. Nam finds it. He's at 8,000. Marco's at 12,800. Ellie is still at -400. He bets 5,000. I like it. Gets the clue. In the 1850s, Congress awarded this man $20,000 for negotiating the Kanagawa Treaty. And I've got it correct with who is Perry.
Yep. And Daily Double number 3 is in 6-syllable words at the $800 level. Marco finds this one at pick number 10. Now's at 17,000. Ellie is still at -400. Marco wagers 3,300, trying to retake the lead, and gets the clue. 19th century liberation fighter Jose de San Martin got about as high in the military as possible, named this of the Republic of Peru. And he can't think of anything. He says, what is a conquistador? They are looking for generalissimo. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought the $1,600 level of that 6-syllable words category was maybe a little controversial. Maybe not. I don't know. From the Latin for conversation, it's an informal or regional expression like bodacious. Nobody tried that. That is a colloquialism. So just the M by itself, you have to treat as a syllable. And I'm not sure if Yeah, right? Because if it's colloquialism, right? Like you treat it like it's one syllable with a consonant cluster, then that's a five-syllable word.
Yeah, for sure.
And
for sure.
I think I haven't gone to like cross-check different dictionaries, but I bet that there are dictionaries that treat that as a consonant cluster in a single syllable rather than two syllables where you're supposed to insert a schwa is like that.
Right.
To make it, to make them separate. Anyway.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Thanks. Good point. I'm full of good points.
So going into Final Jeopardy, Ellie is unfortunately in the red at negative 800. Marco is at 14,700 and M is at 28,200. Just had a really good double Jeopardy. Final Jeopardy category is 20th century authors and The Clue. Best known for a novel, she wrote at least six full-length plays and collaborated with Moms Mabley on a 1931 Broadway review. Marco guessed who is Plath. That is incorrect. He wagered 13,501. And Nam also got it incorrect with who is Hansberry and wagered 1201, which is cover bet. This is Zora Neale Hurston. I mean, you did a deep dive on Zora Neale Hurston, didn't you?
I haven't done a deep dive on Zora Neale Hurston.
Huh. I thought for sure. Yeah. No, you just named your dog after her.
I named my dog after her. Yes.
It's basically the same thing, though.
Although my son thinks that my dog is named after the Zora people. From The Legend of Zelda.
Legend of Zelda. So that makes sense.
That's how I got that one past him.
So Nam wins pretty convincingly going on to Tuesday.
Yeah. So on Tuesday, our contestants are Mark Lashley, a professor from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Leanne Schaefer, a piano teacher and musician from Newton, Massachusetts, and Nam Nguyen, a playwright from Mississauga, Ontario, Canada, whose one-day cash winnings totaled $26,999. And the Jeopardy round categories are presidents and first ladies, culture, popularly, Italian products, words and their meanings, what are you afraid of, and relax, it's math. I am appreciating Ken's hosting chops, and that stood out for me as we headed into the mid-episode break. We had just had the $200 level of relax, it's math, from Latin for twice and cut. It means to divide a line or figure into two equal parts. Nam got that. That is bisect. And then Ken needed to stop play and say, we bisect the Jeopardy round with a commercial break. So we'll be back after these messages.
What and a like, nerd.
Yeah, like he couldn't have planned that, right? Like you needed to hit that one on pick number 15. And I appreciate that he can make nerd jokes impromptu.
Yeah. He's very quick.
Yeah.
And it seems very comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I think he's doing a great job.
Yeah.
I'd never thought about the word trivia, to be honest, but the $800 level of words and their meanings. It's not trivial knowledge that trivia comes from a word meaning a spot where three of these meet. Nam got it. That's a road. Yeah, that makes sense. Three roads. Trivia.
Yeah.
I truly had never given it thought, which seems wrong. I've used that word so much, and it has been such a part of my life. I've just never considered it. Hit a triple stumper at the $600 level of what are you afraid of? Chorophobia, this activity. Nobody tried it. That's dancing. Ken pointed out it's from the same root as choreographer, and Nam said same. With you, man.
Yeah.
All right, Daily Double number one is in Italian products at the $600 level. Pick number 11. Leanne finds it. She's at negative 200 at this point. Nam's at 4,000, Mark's at 1,200. Leanne wagers 1,000. Gets the clue, this car brand's name begins with the first phonetic letter of the NATO alphabet and ends with another. And she gets it correct with what is Alfa Romeo, which is a little bit off on the, I don't know, pronouncing them. You got to wiggle it a little bit, I think, to get to the phonetic alphabet.
If you say R as in Romeo.
Yeah,
when
right.
you're like trying to get the spelling of your street.
Mm-hmm. People are going to be like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But anyway, she does get it. So going into Double Jeopardy, Nam is at 8,600, Leanne's at 2,600, Mark's at 1,800. And the Double Jeopardy categories are the picture of someone named Gray, Shared International Lakes. Name that author. 20th Century Song, 21st Century Ad. I'll Remember Late April. And Pronouns, with pro in quotation marks. The $1,600 level of it, of pronouns, made me obviously giggle. A prominent nose or an elephant's trunk. Mark rang in and said, what is a protuberance? Which is incorrect. Leanne got it. It's a proboscis, which I enjoy that word anyway.
It's a great word.
But there's one of my favorite cold opens of The Office is when Michael burns his foot in the Foreman grill.
Yes.
And I don't remember the exact line, but he says, and I fell and I hit my elbow and now there's a protuberance. And that, I don't know, that just, it made me think of that. It just brings it back.
Yeah.
Makes me giggle. Protuberance.
I finished my full rewatch of The Office. It turns out that I had never watched the last season or so.
Sure.
After Michael Scott left, I kind of moved on, but I'm glad I watched the whole thing now.
Yeah. The character changes of the show for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll say it's not for the better.
Yeah. I guess the same wrong answer as Mark at the $2,000 level of Name That Author. The quote there was, I got in a couple of hassles at the work farm to tell the pure truth, and the court ruled that I'm a psychopath. And Mark tried Who is Salinger. It turns out that's Ken Kesey from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I don't know, something about the voice just sounded Holden Caulfield-ish to me. Didn't quite fit plot-wise, but
sure.
I was like, it's been a while since I read Catcher in the Rye. Maybe there's something like that in there.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I could see that.
Yeah.
See that argument.
Nam got the $800 level of the picture of someone named Gray. Joel Gray did a wonderful job as this character when Wicked premiered on Broadway in 2003. That's the Wizard of Oz. There was a picture. And I got really sort of bogged down in my head trying to think, what are the different male characters in Wicked and who could that be? And I don't remember the name of the goat professor guy.
Yeah.
That's too complicated for Jeopardy. They don't
right.
want you to know the name of the goat professor guy.
Right.
There's knowing a lot of stuff, and then there's knowing how complicated is too complicated for the level of question. And I
right.
feel like you need both to do well on Jeopardy, because at the $800 level, they're not going to be asking for the goat professor guy's name.
The goat professor guy. Yeah. Also, yeah. they had the clue of wonderful in there.
Yeah.
To point you to.
Yeah. Daily Double number 2 is in I'll Remember Late April. It's at the $2,000 level. Pick number 6. Nam finds it. He's at $9,400 with Leanne at $2,600 and Mark at $4,600. He wagers $3,000 and he gets the clue. This organization was founded 80 years ago on April 25th to benefit institutions including Howard and Morehouse. And I think that he kind of knew it. Maybe he guessed UNICEF, and it is the United Negro College Fund, which is the acronym for that would be UNCF. And I wonder if he got those two things combined, because UNICEF is a weird one to land on.
Otherwise.
Yeah. So yeah, rough break there. Drops him down a little bit.
And Daily Double number 3 is in Name That Author at the $1,600 level. Pick number 9, so just a few later, and Nam also finds this one. He's at $8,000, Leanne's at $2,600, Mark's at $4,600, wager's only $2,000, and gets the clue. It was pork making by machinery, pork making by applied mathematics, but this slaughtering machine ran on. And he gets it correct with who is Sinclair. Upton Sinclair, not Sinclair Lewis.
Yeah, so at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Nam is in the lead with $17,600. Mark is at $9,000. Leanne is at $7,000. The final Jeopardy category is business. And the clue is, in the 1850s, the 925 sterling silver standard was instituted by this company, the first American one to do so. I thought of the correct answer here and then rejected it and went in a different direction. I thought that there were a few ways you could go. You could think about sterling silver like jewelry. You could think about sterling silver like silverware. You could think about sterling silver from a banking point of view. And so it's probably a company we know now, but which of those things do we know it for? So Leanne tried what is Tiffany, and that is correct. She wagered everything. That takes her up to 14,000. Mark also got it correct with what is Tiffany and an 8601 wager, bringing him to 17,601. And Nam went in the wrong direction, thought about banking and went with what is Wells Fargo. He wagered 401, which drops him to 17,199. And so with a $402 margin, Mark is the winner going into Wednesday.
So on Wednesday, we have the contestants Amy Hummel, an ER doctor from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Paul Drake, a front desk lead originally from Grand Blanc, Michigan. And Mark Lashley, a professor from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, whose one-day cash winnings total $17,601. Jeopardy round categories are U.S. military actions, celebrity memoirs, hiking gear, etymologies, the right stuff, R-I-T-E, and movement.
I thought a bunch of the etymology clues gave a little too much information, in particular giving a it's related to and like similar to this word kind of clue. Mm-hmm. Right. So the $800 level, an Italian word for embroiled, gives us this word for a complicated situation. And that is embroglio. Like you mm-hmm. basically just take the word that they gave you and say it in an Italian accent. And you're like 95% of the way there. I'm not quite sure how you give an etymology clue for embroglio without saying embroiled, but maybe you just don't.
Or, like, or maybe you put it higher up in the category.
Yeah. Higher in the category would be good. Yeah, I think I was salty about that largely because it was at the $800 level.
Sure. I enjoyed the hiking gear category. Brought me back to my Boy Scout days.
Mm-hmm.
The $1,000 level, though. For drinkable water, bring tablets of chlorine dioxide or this element, which NPS.gov says is a frequently used disinfection agent. Paul got it. That's iodine. It is useful. It's good. If you don't have a reliable clean water source nearby, get some iodine. But also make sure you bring packets of like Tang or Gatorade or whatever, because iodine water almost makes you just want to die of thirst instead.
Yeah, like it is potable.
Yeah, it's not going to kill you.
But drinkable.
It is going to... It's going to make you want to die, though.
Yeah, seems like an exaggeration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. If anybody's actually going to go hiking and bring iodine, they'll probably already know that, but yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Daily Double number one is in celebrity memoirs. It's at the $600 level, pick number four. Mark finds it. He's at 1,000 with Paul at 1,800. Amy's at zero. He wagers everything and he gets the clue. Arnold Schwarzenegger aptly titled his 2012 autobiography, This, the title of his 1990 film. And Mark tried what is Last Action Hero. Is that an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie? All right. That's a great guess. Total Recall is the correct answer here, though.
Yeah. Apparently Last Action Hero was 1993.
Okay. Well,
it's a very good guess. Yeah.
At the end of the Jeopardy round, Mark's at 4,600, Paul's at 5,800, Amy's at 6,000, and the double Jeopardy categories are Near the Equator, Essays, Art and Artists, Engineering Marvels, Music from 10 years ago, which is 2014, and Feel Old Yet, with old in quotation marks.
You don't.
Yes, I do. I do feel
yes,
old.
Thanks. Thanks, Jeopardy writers. Thanks. Once a week, I go in and work with a band, like a high school nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the students in there this week came in and was like, I've been really getting into girl pop music of the 2010s. And I'm like, what do you mean of the 2010s? You can't just say that like it's a thing that's so far gone. And then they're like, yeah, you know, listening to this music from 2012, which is 12 years ago. And I'm like, how dare you?
I guess
how dare you, child?
I guess if you're a high schooler and you were like a literal toddler.
Yeah. Yeah. If this kid's like 16, they were four.
Yeah.
Right?
All right. So preschooler.
But they were like entirely unaware of things.
Yeah.
So it is in the past for them.
Mm-hmm. I did not listen to or engage with any pop music of that time because I had very small babies at that time. So all of this music would be new to me also because I missed it the first time.
Yeah.
I was familiar with the names at least though.
I wonder if Paul being in the audience influenced his miss at the $1,200 level of Near the Equator. Paintings by post-colonial artist Mokke that depict this country include Kinshasa at Noon and Mitterrand and Mobutu. And he rang in and said, what is Ogash? What is Zimbabwe? And we already had a Zimbabwe category, but no.
This is
the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Mm-hmm.
Daily Double number 2 is in Essays at the $1,200 level. Pick number 7, Mark uncovers it. He is at $9,400. Paul's at $7,400. Amy's at $7,200. Any wagers, $2,000. I personally would have gone bigger, try to really get out to a big lead, but maybe he doesn't know Essays. Gets the clue. In jail, Mahatma Gandhi would often read a copy of this 1849 Thoreau essay for inspiration. And Mark guessed, what is self-reliance? But this is, of course, civil disobedience.
And Daily Double number 3 is at the $800 level of Near the Equator. Pick number 19. Amy finds it. She's at $16,000 with Mark at $8,600 and Paul at $7,800. She wagers $4,000 and gets the clue. The largest living monitor lizard shares its name with this island in the middle of the Indonesian archipelago. She can't come up with anything. The correct response here is Komodo. It's the Komodo dragon.
Yes. So at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Mark is at $8,600, Paul is at $9,400, and Amy has gotten herself to $13,200. Final Jeopardy category is historic transports, and the clue, decorated with an illustration of the Montgolfier's craft. The smoking room aboard this could be accessed only via an airlock, and everyone got it correct with what is the Hindenburg.
What in the world were they doing putting a smoking room in a dirigible?
I mean,
just don't smoke on it.
I think we found out what they're doing. I mean, is it too soon to make Hindenburg jokes? Like, where's the statute of limitation on that?
I don't know.
Anyway, they all got it. Mark wagered 801, got a dollar above Paul. Paul wagered 7801 to get above Mark's double up. And Amy made a cover bet of 5700. And so Amy is the new champion.
Mm-hmm. So on Thursday, our contestants are Justin Brandt, an attorney originally from West Hills, California. Tyler Jarvis, a researcher and PhD student originally from Portales, New Mexico. And Amy Hummel, an ER doctor from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, whose one-day cash winnings total $18,900. And the Jeopardy round categories are Gorges Countries, Top 10 Baby Names, the most popular in 2022, according to the Social Security Administration, Assaults and Batteries, Reality Show Hosts, Bro-pourri, and AC in quotation marks.
We just talked about this Social Security Administration and baby names last week.
Yes, we did.
It was a first name places category. Yeah.
Right, that's right. $1,000 level of Gorgeous Countries was a triple stumper, but I knew it because we just booked a trip to this country. The clue was Olduvai Gorge, and Amy tried, what is Spain? That's in Tanzania.
You're going to Tanzania?
We're going to Tanzania.
Cool.
For the Great Migration, late August. Yeah, the Great Migration happens then. The herds of wildebeest migrate to get to, different weather, better grass, something, from Tanzania to Kenya. And the carnivores follow the herds. So it's a very cool time.
To be there.
Yeah, to be there watching wildlife. I'm pretty excited about it.
That's very cool.
Yeah. My daughter is excited, but a little bit grumpy because she was just in a production of The Lion King, and to fully embrace her role as Serafina, the mother of Nala. Serafina has one line, which has one word, but she got very method and started studying Zulu on Duolingo. And so once we got the safari booked, we're like, we've got good news. You might have some mixed feelings about it, though. We're like, we're going to Africa. And she's like, yay. We're like, we're going to Tanzania because that's where the Great Migration is. And she's like, cool. And we're like, we have some difficult news about what language they speak there. And she's like, is it Swahili? I knew I should have gone with Swahili. So I think she's switching over to Swahili on Duolingo.
Sure.
Throwback to my deep dive at the $600 level of AC. One of these with Hidden Pictures Retreats typically begins on December 1st and helps kids count down to Christmas. You all heard that rant last week, I believe. Amy got it. It's an advent calendar.
It is.
Yeah.
It is an advent calendar. funny.
Yeah.
The bro-pery category was all about brothers, which, I don't know, they seem to forget at the $400 level. This company acquired the rights to the British board game Cluedo and renamed it Clue in 1949. Justin, guess what is Hasbro? Tyler, guess what's Milton Bradley? That's Parker Brothers. If you're thinking brothers, you know, it's going to bring you to Parker Brothers.
Yep.
I'll just say none of the baby names in the baby names category, none of them I felt were out of left field kinds of names. Just saying. I will say that is very like ethnocentric of me to look at all of these, and these are all very like white coded names.
Yeah. I mean, there are some white coded names coming out of left field these days, right? Like,
sure,
you know, yeah. Everly with like a Y, two R's and an E-I-G-H, right? Like the wacky names right now that are getting mocked are like the white suburban millennial mom selections.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Daily Double number one is in Bro-pery at the $800 level. Pick number 12, Tyler finds it. He is at $1,800. Amy's at $2,200. Justin's at $600. And he bets it all. Gets the clue. These brothers bought James A. Bailey's business in 1907. And he gets it correct with who are the Ringling Brothers. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Amy's at $5,800. Tyler's at $6,200. Justin's at $800. Double Jeopardy categories are Below Deck, Sailing Novel, Vocabulary, World Holidays and Observances, French History, Let's Rock and Roll, and DC, which is all about Washington, DC.
Yeah. We left four clues on the board in this round. Not really sure how that happened. It didn't feel like it was a particularly slow playing game. We had a few more triple stumpers than, you know, average. But yeah, I'm not totally sure how it is that we ended up running so long that we left so much on the board this time. But we left one $2,000 clue on the board and then three $400 clues. And as annoying as my Christian observances deep dive may have been, I'm feeling good about it, actually, because at the $2,000 level of World Holidays and Observances, once again, there's a clue that you could have learned from my deep dive in Lower Saxony. Wreaths are hung on birch trees to celebrate Pfingsten. This festival celebrated 7 weeks after Easter. I didn't touch on the wreaths and the birch trees. That wasn't one that stood out as I was looking at traditions around this holiday. There's so many kinds of Christianity and so many places. But if you remembered 7 weeks after Easter, that's Pentecost.
Right.
Yeah.
Three triple stumpers in the Let's Rock and Roll category. And like you mentioned, two of those were left on the board. So not a single correct response.
Mm-hmm.
The $800 level, the title of this, Chuck Berry's first hit, reportedly came from a mascara box left on a windowsill in a recording studio. No one tried it. That's Maybelline.
Mm-hmm.
Maybelline. Check out some Chuck Berry. If you never have, it's very easy to listen to. His songs are short because they had to go on the radio. And it all sounds very similar. It's all very rhythm and blues, mm-hmm. just in, you know, a little faster, a little louder,
yeah.
rock and roll. So mm-hmm.
I got stuck on mascara box, which is not the packaging format that mascara comes in the 2020s. But I guess must have been the thing back then.
Sure.
We had a handful of mispronunciations, which is fine. And, you know, Ken sort of gracefully corrected them. We always have some mispronunciations in Jeopardy, but, you know, I think listeners probably know, but if it's a reasonable pronunciation of the word phonetically, they will take it. And I thought it was notable at the $1,200 level of DC after student-led protests in 1988, Dr. I. King Jordan was named this university's first deaf president. Justin rang in and said, "What is Gallaudet? There is a T at the end." So he guessed that it was a French pronunciation with a silent T. Ken said, "Yeah, Gallaudet. It's typically pronounced." But they accepted his, you know, guess that it was a silent T and went with it anyway.
Yeah, it's a reasonable guess based on the spelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Daily Double number two is at the $2,000 level of vocabulary. It's pick number four. Amy finds it. She's at $7,800 in the lead with Tyler at $6,200 and Justin at $2,000. She wagers $3,000 and she gets the clue. Italian gives us this word for an outline of what could happen. Also an old word for a screenplay. She tries what is a schema, but they're looking for a scenario.
Hmm.
I don't know if I would have ever figured that out.
No, I don't think I'd ever have gotten to outline.
Yeah.
For scenario.
Yeah. That,
and Daily Double Number 3 is in French history at the $800 level, pick number 19. Amy finds this one as well. She's at 11,200. Tyler's at 8,200. Justin is at 2,000. And she wagers 2,000. I don't know. She's in the lead, but I would have gone a little bit higher at the $800 level. Gets a clue. Under the terms of the Treaty of Versailles of 1768, the Genoese ceded this island to the French. And she got it correct with what is Corsica.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, led directly to Napoleon.
So at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Amy has a lock game with 18,800. Tyler is at 8,600. Justin's at 2,000. The final Jeopardy category is statues. And the clue is the 42-foot-high statue of Athena in this state capital is the tallest indoor statue in the United States. And this was a triple stumper. Justin tried what is Juno with a $0 wager. I guess I see the logic of being like, you don't want to be outside in Alaska. They put their statues indoors.
Put the statues indoors.
Yeah. So he stays at 2,000. Tyler was writing what is Little Rock, but he didn't get it all written. That is also incorrect. With a $45.99 wager, he drops to 4,001. And Amy had started writing Boston, crossed it out, and wrote what is Springfield. There are many Springfields. Are any of them a state capital? I don't think so.
Illinois.
Right. Oh, yes. Okay. Sorry. You're right. Thank you. So that's incorrect. She wagered just $5. That drops her to 18,795. And the correct response here was Nashville, which has, as Ken reminds us, that big replica of the Parthenon, which I had forgotten existed.
I totally forgot existed, too. I was like, Atlanta, done.
Yeah, I also thought Atlanta.
But it's Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
But Amy had a lock and she wagered correctly based on it. So the outcome was not majorly affected by that.
Yeah.
And that brings us to Friday when we have the contestants Matt Mawinney, a democracy entrepreneur originally from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Dan Byrne, a consultant from Lilburn, Georgia, and Amy Hummel, an ER doctor from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, whose 2-day cash winnings total $37,695. Now, they didn't talk about it in the interview, but I wanted to know what a democracy entrepreneur is.
Yeah.
What does that even mean? I don't know.
No idea.
Yeah. And I guess we'll never know because there's no such thing as the internet. So the Jeopardy round categories are husbands and wives, Japanese cities, lawful quotations, pluralize please, for and after, and the lightning round. The $800 level of lightning round. A party of two. These are Santa's two reindeer, whose names mean thunder and lightning. That's Donner and Blitzen. Do you think... Now, I don't know much about the lore of the reindeer. Are they siblings? Do you think they're twins?
It seems like they would be, right?
I mean, it seems far more likely than that they were just born to different families and happened to be named Thunder and Lightning.
Mm-hmm.
Or do they have no names until they get to Santa, and then Santa's like, now I will give you identity.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Could be that. I wonder if there's any lore implied in the old stop-motion animation, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
That's a good question. I never particularly enjoyed it, so I don't want to go back and watch it to find out, but now I feel like I need to.
I rewatched it around Christmas time and was shocked to realize how queer-coded it all is.
Interesting.
Yeah. So probably somebody's written an essay about it somewhere. I don't know. I haven't looked it up. But I don't know. Just if anybody's rewatching it, see if you think I'm right.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind when I eventually get to it. We had a fun clue with the $200 level of pluralized, please. Sheep, 5 letters. You know, like moose is 5 letters. And Amy seemed unsure when she said, what is sheep? But that's right. Because sheep are sheep. Yeah. And sheep is sheep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. English is weird.
English is weird. Because it can be whatever you want it to be, I guess.
Huh?
And we had a triple stumper at the $1,000 level of Japanese cities. In the 13th century, the port of Fukuoka witnessed this divine wind that scattered and sank a fleet of invading Mongols. Matt tried what is a typhoon, which I think is a fine guess, but that's kamikaze. which is the Japanese word for divine wind.
Yes.
I'm sure we've all heard that word before, but that's what it technically means.
Daily Double number one is in Husbands and Wives. It's at the $800 level, and Amy finds it at pick number six. She's at 1800 with Dan at 600 and Matt at 800. She wagers just 1000 and gets the clue Powhatan and Virginia's governor both gave their permission for this pair to marry. And she gets it correct. It is Pocahontas and John Rolfe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she hesitated just a little bit before saying John Rolfe to, of course, Disney ruins everything.
Yeah. I think I probably would have said John Smith, although I've encountered the actual historical story at some point. Mm-hmm. Anyway, at the end of the Jeopardy round, Amy's at 5,400, Dan is at 6,600, Matt is at 800. And the double Jeopardy categories are Poetry for Thee, Buried at Arlington, Science Stuff, Pop Culture Initials, R2D2 with R in quotation marks and D in quotation marks. Each correct response will have two R's and two D's. And beep, boop, beep.
Beep, boop, beep.
$1,600 level of beep, boop, beep. Boop stands for bronchiolitis obliterans organizing this, an inflammation of lung tissue. Amy got that because she's an ER doctor. It's pneumonia. That is like the least cute boop acronym I've ever heard.
Do you think that when R2-D2 is doing his beeps and boops, that's what he's talking about?
I guess it could be.
Do you think he's actually just like really concerned for people's lung health? But yes. Everyone just treats him like a, you know, like a puppy.
I guess we do see him in a variety of places that would have potential respiratory concerns.
that's fair. That's a good point.
Toss, Tatooine. Like, none of these places seem like the air's ideal.
Dagobah? Ugh. What's flying around in that swamp? Yeah, man. For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. You make a very strong point.
Thank you. Yeah, he's a respiratory health droid. We figured it out here.
And he's like, why am I constantly put in combat situations? They're not my strengths. $1,200 level of Poetry for Thee, yet again.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a shame Lewis Carroll is not alive to rewrite this piece and rhyme Bandersnatch with Cumberbatch. Dang it, that's Jabberwocky. We have already rhymed Bandersnatch with Cumberbatch on this podcast.
I believe we have, yes.
Every so often, we just come back to rhyming with Cumberbatch. And it's always funny.
It is. It stays funny.
Yeah, man, now I want to go back to the rhyme generator. I wonder if it's still up. It probably is. Benedict Cumberbatch rhyme
name generator, right?
Well, whatever.
Is it rhyme generator?
I don't know. Name generator? Sure. Yeah, name generator. Yeah. Buckminster Fullerene.
That's something
That's
else.
That's totally wire. Burger King Copper Wire. Bonaparte Clomby Clomp. I feel like they've lost
that,
it.
That one checks out.
Mm-hmm. But baseball mitt camouflage? I don't know. That's a little bit off.
No, right. No.
I feel like they've had too many.
Yeah.
I think it's lost it. That's too bad.
Jump the shark.
Bombadil scratch and sniff. All right, there's still some good ones. just got to dig. You just got to dig for it. Anyway, back to Jeopardy. I think last week I talked about On the Road. And then the $2,000 level of poetry was about Allen Ginsberg, who's a different beat. Ginsberg saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, and this primal scream of a poem. Amy got it. That's Howl.
A throwback to one of your deep dives at the 2000 level of Buried at Arlington. In uniform, he developed an inoculation against encephalitis, later live virus polio vaccine, opposing Salk's approach. And of course, the name that you should pair with Salk is Sabin. Amy got that one.
Daily Double number two is in Science Stuff. It's at the $1,200 level. It's pick number two. Very early, Matt finds it. He's at 2,000. Amy's at 5,400. Dan's at 6,600. He bets all. Gets the clue, the hormones raging in you right now were secreted by this system of ductless glands. And he gets it correct with, what is the endocrine system?
And Daily Double number three is pick number six at the $1,200 level of Buried at Arlington. Amy finds it. She's at 5,800 with Dan at 6,600 and Matt at 2,400. She wagers 1,500 looking to take the lead, and she gets the clue. Interred in 1993, this Howard University Law School grad led the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund early in his career. And she knows that one is Thurgood Marshall.
Yeah. So going into Final Jeopardy, Amy's in a strong lead at 17,700. Dan is at 10,200. Matt is at 4,000. Final Jeopardy category is U.S. geography, and the clue, at 14,410 feet, it's one of North America's highest volcanoes. A Puyallup name for it can be translated to bring the water. Matt wrote, he started to write, what is Mount St. Helens? Crossed it off. Going for something else. Ken asks, he says he was going for Kilauea. That's incorrect. Jeez, if a Hawaiian island got to 14,000 feet, that'd be extreme. He wagered everything but $2, so he drops $2. Dan got it right with what is Mount Rainier, and then said, hi, Kelly, which is not part of the name, but whatever, they accepted it. He wagered everything but $1, which too much, too much, but he got it right. So he goes up to 20,399, and Amy also got it with what is Mount Rainier, cover bet of 2,800, and she wins her third game. Now, I didn't look it up, but is Mount Rainier named after a person named Rainier, or is it Mount Rainier because it should bring the water?
I mean, I assume the first, but I like that second theory too.
Honestly, like, I got to Mount Rainier because I was like, well, in my mind, it's either Rainier or St. Helens, and rain is water, so that's what I'm going to go with. Also, I feel like Mount St. Helens might be a bit too obvious, but...
yeah.
Well, there we go. Amy wins her third game. And that's the end of the week. And this, this is the point in the show where we remind you that we have a Patreon. It is patreon.com/potentpotables. You can go there to support us financially. You can help us pay for the things that we use to make the podcast, like software subscriptions. At least we don't have to do hardware subscriptions right now, but apparently, this is off topic, but apparently our printer requires a subscription to work.
You've got to be kidding me.
It's like, you bought HP Insta-Ink cartridges. We can't print unless you re-up your subscription to HP Insta-Ink. And I'm like, how did they find a way to make printers even worse? Printers are already the worst machine you put in your home. And they're like, what could we do to make them work even less? Aha. Even if you have ink in the freaking cartridge, you can't use it. All right. Anyway, that's off topic.
That is absolute nonsense.
Yeah. But we have a Patreon, and real humans can help us do human work by supporting us there at patreon.com/potentpotables. You can find some exclusive content and such if you go looking, or if you just want to support us without feeling the need to get something in return, you know, that's also good. But of course, there are more important things in the world, and a lot of things happening right now that could, you know, use your support. So we put some of the causes that we believe in the show notes. So check them out. Emily, what are we talking about?
There were two triple stumper, or, you know, I think in one case, a double stumper, final Jeopardies. So Zora Neale Hurston.
We're talking about Zora Neale Hurston. I was like, it's just two. Yeah. Good.
Yeah, when there's multiple final Jeopardies that go without a correct answer, I at least feel an obligation to pick one of them.
Right, right. But a triple, like a completely missed final Jeopardy feels a little more significant, right? Because as we say many times, final Jeopardy is something that most people should be able to get to. At least most people who get on Jeopardy. So yeah, the Monday Final Jeopardy, 20th Century Authors, best known for a novel. She wrote at least 6 full-length plays and collaborated with Mums Mapley on a 1931 Broadway review. That's Zora Neale Hurston. So that's who I'm going to talk about, because as I asked when we recorded, I was like, didn't you do this? And you're like, no. I'm like, well, probably should then. There were some other good options this week, but I was like, nah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Zora Neale Hurston. And I know that, you know, talking about authors, particularly women authors, tends to be your bailiwick, so hopefully I don't do too bad.
You're gonna do great. I'm looking forward
well,
to it.
Well, now the pressure's on. All right, so Zora Neale Hurston lived from January 7th, 1891 to January 28th, 1960. She was an American author, anthropologist, and documentary filmmaker. She portrayed racial struggles in the early 20th century American South and published research on hoodoo and Caribbean voodoo. And in case you don't actually know what those are, hoodoo is a set of spiritual practices and beliefs that were created by enslaved African Americans in the U.S. South, pulling from various traditional African spiritual backgrounds, as well as elements of indigenous botanical knowledge. So it's kind of a mashup of things. That's hoodoo. And then, of course, voodoo is a bit more of a religious approach, and it's Caribbean, again, kind of taking various influences from places in Africa that enslaved people were brought from into the West Indies. It also mixes in a certain amount of Roman Catholicism in a, to my perspective, interesting and kind of bizarre way. But that's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Zora Neale Hurston. So just to give you an idea of kind of the things she looked at. She was the fifth of eight children born to John Hurston and Lucy Ann Hurston. All four of her grandparents had been born into slavery. Her father was a Baptist preacher and sharecropper, who later became a carpenter. Her mother was a school teacher. She was born in Nottasulga, Alabama, and that was where her father grew up, where his father grew up. But then they moved to Eatonville, Florida, when she was three. And Florida is kind of where she was based for the good majority of her life and kind of mostly the area that she's associated with. Eatonville was one of the first all-Black towns incorporated in the United States, and that was home to her throughout her life. Her father was elected mayor of the town in 1897, and then he was the minister of its largest church in 1902. Hurston often used Eatonville as a setting for her stories, because she viewed it and it was a place where African Americans could live as they desired, independent of white society. In 1901, some northern school teachers had visited and given her some books that opened her mind to literature. She would later describe it as a literary awakening for herself. In her 1928 essay, How It Feels to Be Colored Me, she described her experience of living and growing up in Eatonville, and that's where she spent her childhood. And in fact, Eatonville holds an annual Zora Festival. She was sent to a Baptist boarding school in Jacksonville for a short time after her mother's death, but her father and stepmother stopped paying her tuition, so of course she couldn't stay. In 1916, she was employed as a maid by the lead singer of a touring Gilbert and Sullivan theatrical company. And then in 1917, she attended Morgan College, the high school division of Morgan State University, which is a historically Black college in Baltimore. She was 26, and in order to qualify for free high school education, she claimed 1901 as her birth year instead of 1891. And she graduated from the high school in 1918. She began her studies at Howard University in Washington, D.C. in 1918. She was one of the first members of the Zeta Phi Beta sorority, founded by and for Black women. And she co-founded The Hilltop, which was the university's student newspaper. She studied Spanish, English, Greek, public speaking, and she earned an associate degree in 1920. She wrote a short story, John Redding Goes to Sea, in 1921, and that qualified her to become a member of Alan Locke's literary club, The Stylus. She left Howard in 1924, and in 1925 was offered a scholarship by Barnard trustee Annie Meyer to Barnard College of Columbia University, where she was the sole Black student. She assisted Meyer in crafting the play Black Souls, which is considered one of the first lynching dramas written by a white woman. And she conducted ethnographic research with anthropologist Franz Boas of Columbia University and later studied with him as a grad student. She also worked with Ruth Benedict and fellow anthropology student Margaret Mead, and she got her BA in anthropology in 1928. Through her literary work and her connection to Alan Locke, she was recommended to Charlotte Osgood Mason, who was a philanthropist and literary patron who had supported Locke and other African-American authors like Langston Hughes. So Hurston was recommended to her to, you know, like gain her patronage. She did try to direct their work, Mason did, and she became interested in Hurston's work and supported her travel to the South for research from 1927 to 1932 with a stipend of $200 per month. Mason wanted Hurston to give her all of the material that she had gathered about Negro music, folklore, literature, hoodoo, and everything else she studied. However, at the same time, Franz Boas, the anthropologist that she was working with at Columbia, wanted her to give him the materials. Like, they both wanted what she had found.
Uh-huh.
She spent 2 years studying as a grad student in anthropology after graduating from Barnard, and she lived in Harlem in the 1920s and became part of the Harlem Renaissance crowd with Langston Hughes, County Cullen. Her apartment was apparently a popular spot for some gatherings. She had a few literary successes during this time, placing in short story and playwriting contests in Opportunity, which is a journal published by the National Urban League. In 1927, she married Herbert Sheen, a jazz musician and former teacher at Howard. However, their marriage ended in 1931. In 1935, she became involved with a man named Percy Punter, who was a graduate student at Columbia. He inspired, apparently, the character of Tea Cake in her most popular novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, which I'll talk about the novel a little bit later. She married Albert Price in 1939 while she was in Florida working for the Works Progress Administration. However, that marriage ended after a few months, but they didn't actually divorce until 1943. And then in 1944, she married James Howell Pitts, but that marriage also lasted less than a year. In 1934, she helped establish a school of dramatic arts based on pure Negro expression, like per quotation, at Bethune-Cookman University, a historically Black college in Dayton Beach, Florida. In 1956, she received the Bethune-Cookman College Award for Education and Human Relations in recognition of those achievements. Later in life, she would serve on the faculty of North Carolina College for Negroes, which is now North Carolina Central University in Durham. So she had a lot of resume in higher education, even though, I mean, obviously at the time, as a Black woman, she didn't get a lot of, like, actual respect, you know what I mean? And she also was not able to really build up any kind of, like, fortune or anything like that. She lived kind of hand to mouth for most of her life. Like I mentioned, she traveled extensively in the Caribbean and American South to do anthropological research. She wrote Mules and Men, which is an autoethnographical collection of American folklore, in 1935, based on her research. She also drew from her studies material that was worked into her novels, such as Jonah's Gourd Vine, which was published in 1934. In 1935, she went to Florida and Georgia with Alan Lomax, who, if you're a musician, the Lomax brothers are some of the biggest names in, like, American music in the anthropological sense, like finding American folk music and researching that. And she did research in African American songs and the traditions and their relationship to slave and African antecedent music. She also went to Jamaica and Haiti in 1936 and 1937 with support from the Guggenheim Foundation. From this research, she wrote Tell My Horse from 1938, a genre-defying book that mixes anthropology, folklore, and personal narrative. From 1947 to 1948, she lived in Honduras. She had hopes of locating either Mayan ruins or vestiges of an undiscovered civilization. And it was while she was living in Puerto Cortez that she wrote much of Seraph on the Suwannee, which is her last novel, I believe. During her last decade, she worked as a freelance writer for magazines and newspapers. In the fall of 1952, she was contacted by the editor of the Pittsburgh Courier to go to Florida and cover the murder trial of Ruby McCollum, born Ruby Jackson. McCollum was charged with murdering a white man, Leroy Adams, who was also a politician. Ruby said that she had been forced to bear his child in a practice that was known as paramour rights in the South, which Hurston wrote about numerous times in various works like Jonah's Gourd Vine, as well as others. And so she went to cover that trial. However, there was a gag order placed on the defense that the judge had placed. And she also couldn't get residents of the town to talk about the case. Everyone just kept their mouth shut. So she went back to Pittsburgh and she wrote The Life Story of Ruby McCollum, a serialized account of her attempts down there in 1953. Later on, she would take jobs just to make ends meet. She was kind of like abruptly laid off from the newspaper and she took a job working at Pan American World Airways Technical Library at Patrick Air Force Base in 1956, for which she was fired for being too well-educated the next year. And then she moved to Fort Pierce, Florida, taking jobs where she could find them. She was occasionally a substitute teacher and was on public assistance. She was even a maid at the Rivo Alto Island in Miami Beach. So it was during a period of financial and medical difficulties. She was forced to enter St. Lucie County Welfare Home, where she had a stroke. And that was where she died of hypertensive heart disease in 1960, buried at the Garden of Heavenly Rest in Fort Pierce, Florida. Until 1973, her remains were in an unmarked grave when novelist Alice Walker and fellow scholar Charlotte D. Hunt commissioned a grave marker to go on her grave. After her death, a guy who had been hired to clean the house was just like idly burning Hurston's papers and a law a law officer who like was passing by where she lived and happened to know her saw him doing that and stopped him and saved a big collection of literary documents. He kept them for 2 years, just like trying to find a place to take them. And then finally, the most of that collection was given to the University of Florida Libraries in 1961. So that's her life. And she has had a good amount of posthumous recognition. Like I said, there's the Zora Festival. Fort Pierce has the Zora Neale Hurston House. It is now a National Historic Landmark. Alice Walker, as I mentioned, was a scholar and novelist and has brought her more recognition. Her literary career, like the Jeopardy clue mentioned, she didn't just write novels, right? She wrote, I believe, 4 novels. The first one being Jonas Gordvine in 1934. Their Eyes Were Watching God, which is 1937. It is her most well-known work. And it tells the story of a young woman ripening from a vibrant but voiceless teenage girl into a woman with her finger on the trigger of her own destiny. I'm not going to get into the book. That's not what the deep dive is about. But Their Eyes Were Watching God is like the one to know if you're going to know any of them. In 1939, there was Moses, Man of the Mountain, where she rewrites the story of the Book of Exodus from an African-American perspective. And then 1948, Seraph on the Suwannee follows the life of a white woman and the fraught relationship she has with her husband and family. She also wrote a number of poems, especially early on. Her very first published poem is Journey's End. She wrote some plays like Color Struck, as well as Mule Bone, a comedy of Negro life that she wrote with Langston Hughes. And short stories like Sweat, essays like How It Feels to Be Colored Me. So she continued writing throughout her life, but as you know, as her life shows, it wasn't just like she was a writer, right? She had to work jobs to make ends meet. She was an educator. She was an anthropologist. She was interested in a lot of things, and her writing, I think, kind of came as an expression of those interests. A little bit about her political views. She was fairly conservative. She did not appreciate the New Deal. She believed that it made, in her like quotation, like Negroes dependent on the government and not on themselves. She was not a big fan of integration because she really took on the attitude that basically like, we don't need to bow to the white man. We have fine schools for ourselves, which I think is arguable. Yeah, she was in like today's parlance, we would say that she was a rather staunch libertarian. She was opposed to like communism. She was strongly opposed to communism. She disagreed with, you know, a lot of her contemporaries in their views about like communal, not only living, but like the role of a government to provide for people. So yeah, she was very much leave well enough alone and people should take care of themselves. She wanted everyone to be viewed as an individual first. Yeah, I think that's everything I have. I know I got a little off because I followed different tangents as I was thinking about it, but that's Zora Neale Hurston.
Cool. I knew some of this, but I don't think I'd ever sort of considered her like her life as a whole. I knew little bits and pieces, and it was cool to, you know, kind of pull it all together. So thank you.
Yeah. So you ready for a quiz?
Yes. Let's do a quiz.
All right. So each of the questions in the quiz is kind of like taken from one of the works that I mentioned, whether it's a poem or an essay or a novel. I will say I went with all 4 of her novels, and then one of them is taken from an essay and one is taken from a poem. But I'm not going to tell you what they are beforehand because it might come into the answer. So you have to try to remember what I said. All right, here we go. Question one. In 1987, after more than a dozen years together, what band went their separate ways, largely due to a continuing conflict between lead singer Steve Perry and band manager Herbie Herbert? The wheel in the sky kept turning, though, and they reunited in 1995 with a different manager who had a more any-way-you-want-it attitude. They tour to this day, but only the young would think that any of the original members are still playing.
I recognize that there are many hints. I can hear the music in my head. I can't think of the band name.
I did leave out their most recognizable on purpose, if that helps.
Let's see. Having a hard time thinking of names of 80s bands even now. Like that thing where your mind goes blank.
Yes. Like, I know these things.
Or is like Aerosmith, and you're like, not Aerosmith, and it's like, okay, I've got a different idea. How about
Aerosmith? Yeah, exactly. Yep.
I am not getting to it. I will guess REO Speedwagon.
It's not REO Speedwagon. It is Journey.
Of course it is Journey.
I left out Don't Stop Believin'.
Yeah.
But Separate Ways, Wheel in the Sky, Any Way You Want It, and Only the Young are all number one hits that they had. Or, well, maybe not number one hits, but they're all on their greatest hits album. Yes. Journey. And of course, that is based on the poem Journey's End.
Mm-hmm.
Which I was like, Journey's End? I'll talk about when the band Journey broke up. And then I looked it up and I'm like, oh, they're actually still touring.
Oh, oops.
Just not in the, like, any, you know, iteration that was the original. But hey, I learned. Anyway. All right, you're at 10 points still. That's okay.
Okay.
Question two. This one is based on how it feels to be colored me. My Many Colored Days is a children's book published in 1996 with illustrations by Steve Johnson and Lou Fancher, I think is how you pronounce his name, but I don't know. It was the author's intention that a, quote, great color artist who will not be dominated by me, end quote, do the illustrations. That is a departure from the majority of his oeuvre, which the author also illustrated in his characteristic style. Who was the author who never got to see the completed work since he died 5 years before publication?
Children's author, characteristic style, My Many Colored Days. I don't know it. I will guess Eric Carle.
I should have put other clues in. It is not Eric Carle. It is Dr. Seuss.
Oh, Dr. Seuss.
Yeah, sorry. I realize okay. It's kind of a toss-up there. I didn't give anything necessarily pointing to Dr. Seuss.
Yeah, I did do a deep dive on Dr. Seuss way back, so maybe I should have remembered this.
Hey, that's okay. I get it. Yeah, no, Dr. Seuss wrote it in like the 70s, I think. Yeah, a manuscript in 1974 with a letter attached to it that said he wanted an artist who wouldn't be dominated by him to write about this book, but it wasn't published until 1996. But it's a good book. If you have kids, young kids, My Many Colored Days is, according to the National Education Association, it's one of teachers' top 100 books for children, because it helps, like, it helps put words to feelings, you know?
Yeah.
Like, sometimes you just have a blue day. Sometimes you have a green day. And sometimes you have a gray day. That's okay. All right. You're still at 10 points, but maybe you'll get this.
We'll see. Uh-oh.
All right. Question three. This is based on Jonas Gordvine. Gourds have been used to make many musical instruments in many places and times throughout human history. For 3 points apiece, name any of them. I mean, there's potential to just go ham and get so many points.
All right. How many wrong guesses do I get?
I'll give you 3 wrong guesses.
Okay. Are maracas?
Maracas count. Okay. Originally they were, yes.
All right. There's one that I remember from childhood music and movement classes. I think it was called like a shakeray.
It is a shakeray. Very nice.
Yeah.
Yes, it is a gourd covered in like shells and beads, I believe. Pretty sure that's a shakeray.
Yeah. That sounds right. Yeah. There's like a kind of a string net holding the beads.
Yep.
All right. I've picked up some points.
And if you get 3, I'll round it up to 10.
Okay.
But if you get more than 3, I'll keep going.
Is an ocarina made of a gourd?
That is an interesting question. I will look that up. I don't think so. I want to say it's made out of like potatoes. Peru, they were mostly crafted out of clay. You keep thinking. I'll look up information about the ocarina.
Okay. I suppose I can't just be like a drum.
I mean, yeah, I'll need you to be a little more specific than a drum. I'm looking and I'm not seeing any mention of ocarinas being made out of gourds. They're typically made out of clay, traditionally, or ceramic.
Okay. All right. What about those thumb harp things?
Thumb harp things. Like,
what are those called?
Imbira?
Yeah.
Or kalimba? Kalimba?
Yeah, I think kalimba is what I'm thinking of.
Okay, let's look at kalimba. I don't think so, but let's find out. Let's see. Originally made of bamboo. What are bamboo instrument? I am just going off of the Wikipedia. I am not finding that they used gourds.
All right. What else? The fish-shaped thing with the stick.
I'm going to take that because I know what you're talking about, that you scrape the stick across, right?
It's called that's the one.
Mm-hmm, it's called a guiro. And yes, okay. That is correct. Yes. Ooh. Nice. So you've got up to 10 points. If you get more, right. You'll keep going. If you want to just call it there, you can call it there.
But well, I have a third wrong guess. Let's just throw bongos out and get it wrong.
No, bongos, typically no, not made of gourds.
Okay. All right, cool.
Nice. All right. So yeah, you got there. Yeah, the guiro, G-U-I-R-O. Yes, I often call it a fish. And a lot of times they're like painted to like look like fish. So I will accept that.
I'm not sure if my childhood music and movement teacher is so proud of me right now or the opposite.
You got the three that I feel were most common that like an American would mm-hmm. know. The guiro, maracas, yeah. Shekere. Sitars mm-hmm. traditionally actually the rounded bottom portion were originally made of.
Oh, that's crazy.
Gourds.
I thought about sitars and then was like, no. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Yeah, a lot of other like African instruments, like the kashishi is a mm-hmm. drum that's usually made out of gourds. The balafon is a like xylophone sort of thing with gourds underneath that act as resonators. Mm-hmm. So, and then various different types of shakers and things like that, like kind of variations on the shekere or maraca. But very mm-hmm. nice. All right, you got 10 points. Well done. That was a hard mm-hmm. one. You're at 20 points. Question 4. This is based on their eyes were watching God. An oracle is a person or thing considered to provide insight, wise counsel, or prophetic predictions, most notably including precognition of the future, inspired by deities. In American comics, a character named Oracle appears in both the DC and Marvel universes. They are different characters. In the Marvel comics, she is associated with a group of mutant superheroes who are not the Avengers. And in DC comics, she is a sidekick of an individual who isn't technically a superhero. Name either the Marvel group or the DC hero.
Is it X-Men?
It is X-Men, yes. Ooh. Oracle is associated with the X-Men, yes. Her alter ego is Lady Sybil, which is based on like the Sybilese Oracle. She has telepathy and can exert control over others' minds. First appeared in Uncanny X-Men in number 107 in 1977. Mm-hmm. The DC comic one is with Batman. Not to be a spoiler for a 35-year-old story, but Barbara Gordon, who was Batgirl, gets shot by Joker and loses the use of her legs. And so she becomes Oracle and helps out Batman from behind the scenes. All right, nice. You're at 30 points. Question 5. Franconia Notch is a U-shaped valley in the White Mountains that was shaped by glaciers. Abenaki legend states that Nizkizos, a good and successful leader, kept a constant vigil for his lost beloved atop a mountain there. In 2003, it is said that he was reunited with his beloved. What state is this landmark in?
New Hampshire.
It is New Hampshire. Yes. Nice. I was hoping, I was like, this is kind of ambiguous, but I think she'll know what we're talking about. Yes. The Old Man of the Mountain, according to the local native legend, is that there was a leader whose beloved was from a different tribe and she had to go home because there was a sickness. And so he would sit on the mountaintop waiting for her, but she died of the sickness back home. And so he remained there forever waiting. But then, of course, the Old Man of the Mountain collapsed in 2003, and it is thus said that he has been reunited with her.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice. Uh-huh. You're at 40 points? 40 points.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Yeah, 40 Going points. Into the final, and the final category is angelology.
Angelology. I guess I'll wager all of them.
Probably a good idea. This is based on Seraph on the Suwannee. In medieval Christian lore, seraphim are the highest choir of angels. In the highest ranks, along with cherubim and ophanim. How many wings does a seraph have? No, that's a bad number. How many pairs of wings does a seraph have? That's a much better number.
Is it 6 wings or is it 6 pairs of wings?
Are you asking me or?
I'm asking myself.
Okay.
I think it's 3 pairs of wings.
Are you stating that as your answer or are you ruminating?
I am ruminating. Okay. Sorry. I'm trying to remember the opening of Isaiah without having it in front of me.
You know what? You could probably do the color commentary on this one better than I could.
I think it's 3 pairs of wings. I think it's 6 wings. I'm going to go with it.
And that's correct. Nice. Yes, they have six wings or three pairs, because of course six mm-hmm. is a six is an unholy number and three is a very mm-hmm. holy number. So yeah. Yes. Nice. Yeah, you were talking about Isaiah. A lot of that comes from readings of Isaiah by a guy named Pseudo Dionysius the Areopagite. Sure. Yeah. Christian Greek author and theologian in the like 5th and 6th century. He wrote a book on the celestial hierarchy and described all of these orders of angels. And then everyone after that was kind of like, yeah, cool. All right. That makes sense. Yeah. Like Thomas Aquinas wrote about it too. And St. Bonaventure also worked on that. So yeah, I didn't really dive deep into the angelology, but I was like, huh, I wonder. So very nice. You're at 80 points. You got there.
Yay, I got there.
I gave you a rough start, but that's a good score. Mm-hmm. Nice job.
Yeah, no, and those and they were fair questions. I just didn't know the answers. But this was fun, as always. So thank you. And I hope it was fun for our listeners as well. Thanks for being here, listeners. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a rating or review if you have a minute to do that. Our Patreon is patreon.com/potentpodables if you want to go check that out. And if you have friends who like Jeopardy, let them know about us.
You can all find us on Facebook at Potent Potables, on Twitter at PotentPotables1. Our email address is potentpotablescast@gmail.com, and our website is potentpod.com.
That's right. And I'll be back next week with a guest, is the plan, TBD, while Kyle is elsewhere. So until then, may your minds be quick and your buzzers be quicker.